Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we revisit your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Jane Dempsey.
Hi, John. It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jane is one of my Facebook friends, and I thought you might want to tell the audience out there a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a 20-something in Chicago. I met John through a podcast, I guess your brother's podcast, and the Facebook group that entails. I am a writer, improviser in Chicago, young Black woman, just, you know, living it up in the Midwest.
This time we are doing Zora Neale Hurston's 1937 novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Which is not a book I read in high school. I think it's getting taught a lot more in high school these days. But I went to a little school in Eureka, Illinois, as I've mentioned many times before, and they had a kind of a hands-off approach when it came to race, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't read a lot of the great African-American authors until I got to college, and especially in graduate school, I took a wonderful course on the Harlem Renaissance, which is where I first read Their Eyes Were Watching God. What's your background with this novel?
Well, I grew up in a predominantly white, somewhat small northern New Jersey suburb. So we did read it in 10th grade, my honors English class. It's so happened to be my least favorite English class of my high school career. I'm a teacher that was not very interested in teaching, which is never fun. And it was very awkward to be one of the few people of color reading Their Eyes Were Watching God in my high school class.
Well, I can imagine. Now, I think this is that's quite appropriate, because as we get into this book, the relationship of this book to sort of the overall pattern of African-American literature is a complicated one. Because when this novel came out in the midst of the Harlem Renaissance, it was not well received by many of Hurston's fellow Black authors. Especially Richard Wright didn't like it a lot.
Yes. In fact, one of my favorite authors, Ralph Ellison, who wrote Invisible Man, said the book contained a blight of calculated burlesque, which is a very flowery way to dismiss a book.
To understand a little bit about this, let's talk just briefly about Hurston. Hurston was trained primarily as a folklorist and ethnographer. She was a student of Franz Boas, and his ideas on race, I think, really come through in this book. And one of the things that Hurston was dealing with was, just prior to the Harlem Renaissance, there had been this idea put forth by W.E.B. Du Bois that Black literature needed to conform to sort of a program of racial uplift. In other words, it needed to present the Black characters in a very flattering light and show them engaged in sort of noble endeavors and overcoming hardships. The Harlem Renaissance writers reacted against this, but they kind of reacted to this mostly by showing the way in which systemic oppression and racism affected the lives of the Black characters.
I definitely think that a lot of the Harlem Renaissance writers, while they did talk about the, you know, plight of the Black existence, usually in terms of being, you know, oppressed by the larger white society, I think that when Zora Neale Hurston delved away from her anthropological work, the fact that Their Eyes Were Watching God was a book mainly about more or less lower class Black people in Florida, and she chose to write in that specific dialect, I think that it gave them pause and made them uncomfortable, kind of being exposed in this book, an aspect of Black society that they did not want to be brought into the forefront.
I really like you bringing up dialect, because that's the one of the really remarkable things about this book is the use of dialect, and it's very thick in all of the dialogue in the book. On the other hand, the narrative voice is highly literate and sort of outside of time almost, and kind of this the narrative voice that of a almost a divine position. People talk a lot about the divided voice of this book, but I think I don't know. What did you find that difficult to get through, or I found it kind of a very attractive aspect of this book.
I do remember during my sophomore year when I read this book, I did struggle with the dialect. I mean, I am Black, but my family comes from Jamaica, so that's its own set of dialect. So this sort of African-American vernacular, if you will, I was not accustomed to it. And my sophomore year teacher did make us learn quote-unquote African-American vernacular, which was very awkward in my white classroom. But to answer your question, the second reading, I definitely thought the marriage of the two voices was great, and I thought that it showed kind of the importance of elevating these people that are so often marginalized and ignored by society.
The other thing that strikes me about this book is that it talks very bluntly about racial issues within the Black community. And I think that was kind of an airing of dirty laundry that may have offended some of Hurston's contemporaries.
Definitely. As she wrote another short story, I'm thinking specifically of the character of Mrs. Turner, who between her and Zora's short story called Colorstruck, she really brought to the forefront the idea of colorism, which, you know, in the Black community is the preference of lighter skinned individuals that have more European features versus darker skinned people, which stems from slavery more so, because the lighter skinned slaves who are usually multiracial or biracial would work inside, whereas the dark skinned people would work in the field. Slight crash course into colorism. There is that character who was so obsessed with whiteness, and even the, you know, the characters in the, you know, just around the muck and the swamps with Tea Cake, just always shooting the shit, for lack of a better word, and in the end defending Tea Cake's death and trying to get Janie in jail.
And the other thing that strikes me very strongly in this book, because earlier in this series of Sophomore Lit, we read Raisin in the Sun, that is a play which features the politics of Black hair. And in this book, the politics of Black hair come to play again, insofar as Janie has what is seen as very white hair, very straight, long, and seen as very desirable, but also marks her as apart and causes the other women in her community to eye her with suspicion.
Yeah, because it's pretty certain that she is biracial. She never really knew her father. And, you know, it's so covetous in that community. And I think in so many Black communities, unfortunately, that when her second husband, Joe Starks, becomes extremely jealous and possessive of her and tries to make her hide it at all times when she works in the store.
Is there anything else you want to talk about from a background point before we start in on the story itself?
I'm really glad that I read it the second time, because I think the environment I read it in gave me a bit of a chip on my shoulder to this book, and I felt upset with myself that I didn't like it, because it's such a renowned book, especially by the 1990s. But upon, you know, rereading it, I definitely have fallen in love with Janie. A lot of the literary criticism I've read, even modern times, you know, does make Tea Cake out to be, you know, her true love, and the third time around she found someone that really loved her. But I don't really like
him. That's a very interesting point. Because, as you mentioned, Hurston had a revival mostly in the 70s. Henry Louis Gates wrote on her, and particularly Alice Walker wrote a very famous essay for Ms. Magazine that kind of brought her back to the forefront. When I read this in graduate school, all the women in the class were very suspect of tea cake because, of course, we'll, as we'll get into it, there are issues of domestic abuse and how the novel deals with that that they found unsatisfactory. But maybe we should save that for when we get to that part, point in the story.
Sure.
So let's talk about the plot. This book is, you know, was written in 37. I think it starts around the turn of the century. Do you know what date exactly? I can't remember.
Off the top of my head, it might be 1909.
Yeah, something like that.
And
it starts with Janie Crawford. Actually, it starts with a flashback. So it starts with Janie Crawford, who is introduced without a name, actually, at the beginning, returning to her town as something of a pariah, as an outcast, and the local women viewing her with distrust and talking about how she ran off with a younger man and now she's back. But Janie returns to the town she used to live in and meets up with her friend Phoebe. And the entire story is told as an extended flashback of Janie explaining to Phoebe what her life was like and what happened. It doesn't adopt a first-person narrative, but we see it in the context of this first-person narrative. And so Janie Turner, we pick up with her in Chapter 2, when she is 16, I think. And she is a young woman who is living with her grandmother, as you mentioned, of mixed race. We eventually learn that both her grandmother and her mother had... I know that her grandmother had was basically raped under slavery. And her mother had a relationship with a teacher, and I don't remember whether or not they ever say what race he was or not. But the point is that Janie is so light skinned, she grows up as a child thinking that she's white,
right?
Until one day the kids start making fun of her, and she realizes that she's black, and then she has this kind of epiphanal experience where she is lying under a tree and watching the bees pollinating the flowers. And this is the awakening of her budding sexuality, a very lovely passage, being kind of in the mood and it being spring. She kisses a local boy and raises the ire of her grandmother.
That's such a beautiful passage. Her, you know, by the pear tree and just really awakening her sexuality. And I think Zora is really clever with kind of, I guess, ending that whole segment and kind of jutting in that Johnny Taylor boy to kind of steal a kiss from her, and kind of her sexuality is very personal to herself in that moment, and then is suddenly Johnny Taylor kind of captures it.
Right. Now, it that's a good point you make about sort of the personalness of it, because this Janie experiences sexuality as this kind of transcendent moment of oneness with nature, whereas her grandmother can't help but see it all in terms of the social context. She's very concerned about her charge not falling into the same difficulties that she and her mother did.
I think that the first few pages of the book capture it so well, where, to paraphrase, it kind of says that men go out and they suffer loss and they do their thing and they go out adventuring, the ship metaphor, and then the women just go out and do the best and get things done. That was some great butchering of Zora Neale Hurston by Jane Dempsey. No. But it is basically just to say that men are often the ones adventuring out and doing all of that sort of a bold choices that they make, and the women are just kind of left to, they're just left, basically. And I think that's where her grandmother's view comes from, is that you're a woman, you have to be realistic, you can't be romantic about love, you have to stay grounded.
To go back again to Raising the Sun, there's a wonderful speech there given by the matriarch of that play, where she is talking to her son about how for her generation, survival was the important thing, and for grandmother, right, the survival is the important thing. There is this hope with this younger generation, and especially we'll get to it because Janie will eventually become part of the whole experiment at Eatonville, the first Black American town that's completely owned and run by African Americans. That was a really big deal. So it's an interesting story for me for the way in which the personal intersects with history. We have Eatonville, we have the big hurricane, but it really does remain throughout Janie's story.
Yeah, absolutely. I can quickly read the two paragraphs. I was just paraphrasing just because I felt.
Sure.
So,
go ahead.
So, such a disservice to Zora. So, ships at a distance have every man's wish on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forever on the horizon, never out of sight, never landing until the watcher turns his eyes away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men. Now, women forget all those things they don't want to remember, and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. Then they act and do things accordingly. So I think that strikes me so much with this first part of Their Eyes Were Watching God, because basically what Janie's doing is acting and doing things accordingly, but not doing what she wants, which I think is the brunt of the novel.
Speaking of that, her grandmother immediately arranges a marriage for her to the first of her husbands in this book, Logan Killix. And this book is told kind of in a series of marriages, but I think it's I love that Hurston kind of sets up certain expectations about the way the novel's going to go, and I think completely just abandons those in a very organic and wonderful way. Because, again, this is Janie's story, and it's not going to, you know, marriage is traditionally, since Shakespeare's time, is the climax of the story, and that's not going to be the case in this book at all.
Yeah. Marriage is such a huge thing in the African American community because during the times of slavery, it was not allowed at all. Slaves would get together merely for forced procreation. And so the idea that this woman in the 20s, 30s not only left her first husband, but then got married three times is pretty insane.
As you mentioned, she leaves her first husband. I mean, it's a very short passage. This marriage, Logan turns out to be completely interested in having a farmhand. Basically, that's all Janie is to him. He's a much older man. He's not particularly interested in her sexually. At least it's not emphasized. That aspect of the relationship isn't emphasized at all, and he's just concerned with having someone who can help out in the fields. One of the things that I really love about this book is Janie basically meets her second husband, Joe Starks, who is passing through and flirting with her, and she starts to entertain the idea of leaving her first husband, and she kind of gives her first husband Logan a chance to redeem himself. She's like, says, what would you do if I left? And kind of like says, gives him a little chance to fight. And he doesn't seem to be particularly interested in fighting. And so she goes. And I really, really love the fact that Janie is allowed to follow her desires without the narrator punishing her, because so many books around this time, so many great books of American literature are about women following their passions and their and maybe having affairs or leaving husbands, and then they have to be punished in some way.
The first one that comes to my mind that I did read in high school was The Awakening by Kate Chopin,
right,
where she like literally drowns at the end.
Right. Your Sister Carrie, you got Madame Bovary, which is a great novel, mm-hmm. but I always couldn't stand the way that at the end they just had to like really, really right. punish her. Anyway, do you want to say anything more about the first marriage? The first marriage is kind of done with rather quickly.
Yeah, it's... I think Zora purposely made it a bit inconsequential. I think that's the point. He, you know, was taken by her looks, like many of the men were, but then pretty much ignored her. So at the time, Joe Stark seemed very appealing.
So Joe Starks is a kind of this itinerant guy who is something of a spender. He's coming through and he's talking about he's got big plans, and he takes Janie with him down to Eatonville, Florida, which was one of the first incorporated cities that was entirely run by African Americans. And this is an interesting point to make, that after the end of the Civil War and during Reconstruction, there were lots of questions about how Black Americans would, or if they could, be brought into the larger fold of American society. And there was a certain movement among African Americans to go off on your own. I mean, when was Liberia founded? This was around...
I honestly want to Google it because it's going to bother me. That also made me think this was around the same time, because I know Ralph Ellison. Okay, Liberia was founded. It's actually... That's what I thought, way before, 1821.
Oh, really? Much earlier. I thought it was after the war, but I'm wrong.
No, but this was the time, because this guy was more or less parodied in Invisible Man, where Marcus Garvey, that Jamaican philosopher and activist, basically was speaking of the separatist movement of Black people just basically separating from themselves. So that talk was definitely high in the Harlem Renaissance.
Eatonville is kind of a town, the way that Zora Neale Hurston writes it, it's a kind of a town of good intentions, but without, with sort of a power vacuum. And when Joe shows up, that he's kind of that power, because he comes in with a great deal of money to throw around. And one of the first things he does is buy up some more land to add to the incorporated town, which he immediately turns around and sells to new settlers to the city. So he also brings in a general store that he brings to Eatonville, and he and Janie make a very elaborate house. So Joe brings a certain amount of authority to the town, but he also is quick to sort of establish an upper class here. He's an upper class made up of him and Janie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about the historical Eatonville. Do you know anything about it?
I can't. I actually went there.
Oh, yeah?
About 10 years ago. One of my relatives is from Gainesville, but I just remember that it was, you know, incorporated by African Americans, and it's, I don't know, that's all I remember, unfortunately.
And there follows a much longer portion of the book describing Janie's life in Eatonville. Mm-hmm. Joe sets her up in the store, where she's useful because she's so pretty. She brings in a lot of customers, but she's not allowed to interact with the customers in any way.
Yes. He definitely is very, very controlling about how she presents herself. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, this might be the introduction of the overalls, which
Yes.
get called back again and again, just because that's not the most alluring look, I guess, in Eatonville.
Right.
Even the one guy, Amos, does try to steal her away from Joe and, not successful at all. And it really, just any thought of a man taking Janie just drives Joe insane.
Right, and the part of the reason it's so hard for Janie is this store becomes such a center of the community in Eatonville. It becomes a place for the men to congregate and especially to play checkers. But she's forbidden. It's not just Joe who forbids her. It's the mores, the town, and the ideas of what the correct rules are for women and men. There are plenty of very colorful little incidents in here. And one of the things that's kind of funny is Joe purchases a lamp, what is it, a lamppost for the town, because this is supposed to be now the town has made it will have a lamppost. And it's a very funny segment that really underscores Joe's, who he is. He's a guy who has this natural ability to charm people, but there's no real substance there.
Yeah, he definitely has a knack to be ostentatious. And this is the part, right, where the people in Eatonville do have the running joke about that mule
Right.
who sadly like eventually dies. But I thought that was a great device of just kind of just humor and that kind of never-ending story that becomes more than the actual thing.
Right. Now this is a funny point too, because the mule you're talking about is an old skinny mule that is mistreated by his owner, and Janie doesn't like this and is says, to stop, to her husband, she wishes that they would stop beating it. And Joe buys the mule, but partly, to be nice to Janie. I mean, it's a mixed relationship. It's not a great relationship, but it's but I think none of the relationships in here are all bad or all good. But it's also a chance for Joe to give another one of his big speeches. And then you mentioned when the mule dies, Joe gives a eulogy for the mule, and then the mule, in one of the strangest segments of the book, the mule is set upon by vultures.
Yeah, and then that one, man, like Zora Neale Hurston just like personifies the vultures. They like take turns. They have objectives, tactics.
They talk in a this sing-songy call and response way that really made me wonder when I was reading this if she was describing some sort of a folk way, because they have this little chant about how the mule died. And so, I spent a while fruitlessly Googling this. I remember in the graduate course when we got to the segment, everyone was saying, "What is this? Is this some sort of a folk song?" But I think it's Hurston playing with words the way that she loves to play with words, and probably being an ethnographer, makes sense that she would draw on that tradition.
Actually, I don't know if the vultures at all was any sort of allusion to John Crow. Just the animalistic and the barbarianism and just the leeching off of this poor dead animal who's completely victimized. I wonder if she was trying to allude to the kind of barbaric underlying nature of the rules set up in Jim Crow America, rather.
That's a really good point. Well, I'll think about that a bit.
I think I thought about it just because, well, there's Jim Crow, and in Jamaican patois, it's like Jang Crow, which is technically like a type of vulture in Jamaica.
Huh.
And so I was kind of like,
Wow.
maybe, but I don't know.
Hurston's folklore was writings were mostly from the Caribbean, weren't they?
I don't know. Honestly, this is going to make me read more Hurston because this has definitely made me rediscover her.
Relationships between Joe and Janie become very strained, and after many years of an unsatisfactory marriage, there's a blow up at the store involving Janie cutting a plug of tobacco incorrectly and being made fun of, and Janie publicly shames Joe, saying, you know, I may be getting older, but you're not getting any younger yourself. And Joe moves out of the house. It's an interesting move by Hurston, because the narrator tells us that Joe isn't really angry with Janie, but he wants to pretend he is. It's kind of slightly touching that the narrator is trying to give us a little bit of a look inside Joe's psyche at this point, because Joe has been kind of horrible to Janie this whole time.
Right.
But shortly after he moves out, he also becomes very sick. And although he consults some folk doctors about what's gone wrong with him, Janie calls in a medical doctor who tells her that his kidneys are failing and that he's not, there's nothing that anyone can do. And there's a great, the farewell speech between Janie and Joe is another one of these, I think, beautiful moments. I mean, it's Janie is not willfully cruel to Joe, but she wants to be heard before he dies. One of the things that people talk a lot about in this book is the importance of voice in this novel, that Janie is perpetually in trying to find her voice and trying to be heard. And I think that this marks, I think, a real turning point for a character where she underscores, you know, for once in your life, you're going to hear me before you die.
Yeah, I think that it's such a striking change in Janie in the book. After he dies, she then goes into the mirror, and that's the first time she really realizes. She says something along the lines of, you know, the young girl is gone, but a handsome woman has taken her place. And that's when she finally takes her hair out of the bandana. So it almost feels like the last conversation she had with Joe, it does between her and Joe, but not with the townspeople, absolve her of any sort of grief or stiltedness that would keep her from pursuing happiness in life.
Again, I think this is Hurston confounding a lot of traditional narrative devices, because the idea of the sad widow or the woman alone in her 40s, this is kind of the end of many stories. But this is the point, I think, where Janie's life really starts to really be her own. I don't want to overplay that. As I reread this book, I'm constantly amazed at how nuanced everything is. I think that Janie is certainly trading up in life, but it's not as though at any point in her life is a tragedy. It's there are good things and bad things, and she embraces the good things and she endures the bad things.
Yeah, I think that she definitely powers on through life, and she goes from doing what she thought she should do with marrying Joe and being this idea of a mayor's wife, which was very limiting, and then boldly going on and moving on with Tea Cake, who has no money at all.
Right. And who is something like 20 years younger than her. So Tea Cake now breezes into the story.
He definitely breezes into the story. Oh, Tea Cake.
Now, he's a very charming, much younger, and for the first time, the book becomes really, really sexy. I mean, since the bees and the pears, this is the...
Very true, very true. Nothing sexier than his real name, Virgil.
Virgil.
I can see why he went with Tea Cake.
He shows up at the store, and one of the reasons he charms Janie immediately is he asks if she would play checkers with him, which is, it's such a wonderful encapsulation of the what was wrong with gender politics in Janie's life and how refreshing it is for her to have a guy just ask her to play checkers. And he flirts with her and he's funny with her and she's able to be funny with him. That's a really important thing, is that in their conversation, they can throw barbs at each other. They can give and take, and it's almost immediate mm-hmm. that she falls deeply head over heels for him. But he's a kind of a flighty, flitty guy. You know, he's in and out. In these first couple chapters, he comes and he disappears for some weeks at a time. And then he comes back again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know that Janie has her trepidations because a foreshadowing in Eatonville, she does think about that one wealthy widow in Eatonville who had a younger fiancé who took away her money and then fled it, right as soon as possible. And she doesn't want to relive that, and she knows people will talk. But she does confront Tea Cake saying, I am much older than you. I'm afraid, you know, this might not be the best thing, or you could want me just for my money or what have you. And he reassures her that none of that stuff matters to him.
Shortly after they become a couple, TK announces that they should leave Eatonville behind and go off to Jacksonville to work in the muck, which is what they call the muddy fields out there where sugarcane is grown. And it's an interesting move here, because of course Janie at this point, after the death of Joe, has she's financially pretty well set up, and she has a store, she has a going business concern, although she's got a kind of a new lease on life here in middle age, it's a kind of an odd time to be packing up and starting a life of manual labor. What did you think about that? That was a kind of an find yourself swept up with the romance of it, or did you think, Janie, what are you doing?
Here's the thing, John. So I think what she did, the moving to Jacksonville to be with Tea Cake, that's all great. And I support her. I'm acting like she's a dear friend of mine. The red flag I got was the whole issue with the $200.
Right.
When she tries to secure it, but then Tea Cake does discover it, and his first inkling is, let me gamble it all because I'm so good at gambling. I mean, his intention, he says, is to make enough money for them to live comfortably, because I guess he still wants to be the man and all that type of stuff, but still just gambling it all away. Ugh, I've forgotten that, and rereading it, I was like, no, I thought we loved Tea Cake. Oh no.
The other thing that marks this this relationship is some domestic issues. There's that sequence between Tea Cake and that the other woman,
Nunky.
Yeah. Janie finds Tea Cake and Nunky in a clinch out in the patch of cane. It's supposed, yes. We're told that there's nothing untowards about it, but it seems pretty suspect to me.
Seems pretty untowards.
Yeah.
Seems pretty untowards.
And she tries to beat Tea Cake. Janie does, but but he holds her off, and I'm sure that this is, you know, this is a very sexy relationship, but like a lot of novels written this time, there's not really any descriptions of sex, but you get the picture. This is one of those Hollywood moments where they start hitting each other and they roll over into bed together.
Right. Yeah.
But sadly enough, it's followed up with Janie was speaking with this woman you were talking to, Mrs. Turner, who is a black woman who has a marked preference for light-skinned black people and thinks that Tea Cake is way too dark-skinned for Janie. And she has a mm-hmm. brother of her own that she wants to set Janie up with. And this is the part where Tea Cake, in an effort to show who's boss, beats Janie. And it's dealt with in a very strange way in the book. It's kind of like off page almost. It's like
like a Greek tragedy,
right? It's like exactly, it's reported by the narrator, and then mm-hmm. people talk about the incident, and we never get to hear Janie respond to this. And I think, you know, when I was in class, this was the part that everyone got very squeamish about, like, what do you do with this, because it's kind of brushed off almost by the narrator. And it's unclear why it's even included.
I think that just from my takeaway from Their Eyes Were Watching God, and people can disagree with me, I think that at the end of the day, it's about Janie discovering herself. And I think it's a incorrect synopsis to say it's about Janie finding the love of her life in Tea Cake. Because I think that he was the best out of them all, but he still had, to me, some very damaging flaws. Best made into metaphor with him. Can I get into the rabies?
Yes, you go ahead.
Okay, into the rabies and her having to kill who she loves. But that's sort of my takeaway, because I don't think that Tea Cake is this valiant person that, you know, was just someone who saved Janie or what have you.
Right. Let's talk about this last part of the novel, the last part of the big hurricane, which is mm-hmm. it's important to point out that as itinerant field hands, Janie and Tea Cake are living in lodging with a bunch of other farmhands. There's kind of these lodging houses that are these big cabins out there that you pay to kind of flop in, and there's like eating halls and stuff. There is a hurricane that comes up. This is the Okeechobee hurricane, which actually was a huge, huge hurricane. When was that? That was 1928. And it did sadly cause the death of thousands of field workers, and again mostly African American, who were living out in these lodges in the Everglades. And these chapters are very powerfully written. I would yes. really encourage anyone to read the whole novel, but if you really wanted to read some really amazing descriptions, the passages of the leading up to the hurricane and what happens during the hurricane are fascinating. And in the middle of the night, when the worst the hurricane is coming on, Janie and Tea Cake decide they're going to take their chances and leave the lodge that they're in, and they go out by night. And there's this, you mentioned the rabies, this crazy passage where Janie is being washed out by the flooded waters from the lake, and the only way to save herself is to catch hold of the tail of a cow who mm-hmm. is swimming out in the water, but who has a dog on its back who is not happy to see Janie.
Yeah, and then Tea Cake tries to, you know, save her, and the dog bites him in the cheek. And at the time, they're really glad, like, oh, it's not my eye, at least. And they, you know, they do survive the hurricane. And a lot of the people that they were looking out for beforehand do actually end up surviving. But unfortunately, about a month later, Tea Cake does start to act very strange. I think that Zora Neale very masterfully kind of lets it creep up on you with just his, suddenly he's very irritable, and then he, you know, cannot stomach water. And that's, I think, the big giveaway to the rabies that is driving him mad. She calls it the demon and the fiend that's, you know, making him do these bad things.
Janie calls in a doctor who confirms that it's rabies, and the doctor wants to take Tea Cake and have him taken to a hospital, not because there's necessarily any chance of his being saved, but because he's such a risk to the people around him. And Janie doesn't want to do that to Tea Cake, but Tea Cake threatens her. One of the things that Tea Cake did actually before this is he taught Janie how to shoot a gun. And so in the dramatic climax here, Tea Cake is pulling a revolver on Janie, and Janie has, what is it, like a rifle?
Mm-hmm. Shoots him.
It's
here. I was hating on Tea Cake, and I'm still a little sad about it.
Yeah. Now this is like a Han shot first moment, because he, as he crumples down, Tea Cake also shoots, and she, I think Hurston wants us to be absolutely on board with the fact that Janie had to do this. Tea Cake, as he's crumbling down, fires and takes off a bit of her hair.
God, that is a really hard passage, just because I think that even the choice of rabies, it's such an animalistic and irreversible thing that she had no choice but to kill him.
There's a segment here where Janie is shunted off into custody, mm-hmm. and rapidly through the court system, she's going to be tried for having shot her husband. And at this point, a lot of critics make a big deal out of the fact that Janie doesn't talk much in this next chapter. She's kind of mm-hmm. she's kind of ushered into first into custody and then into a courtroom where other people talk against and for her. And
it made me think of, I think this is really powerful, because I thought in this instance, this is one of the few moments aside from, say, the doctor, where there are a lot of white people in a scene. And I almost feel like this was written to kind of show from their perspective, like, oh, here's this quiet, meek, shook up black woman who, I guess, shot her husband, what have you. And they don't really understand the rich inner life and outer life that we have been reading up to. It made me think of one of my favorite plays. Have you read Intimate Apparel?
No, I haven't.
It's by Lynn Nottage, who wrote Ruined. And basically, at the end of the day, Intimate Apparel is about this African-American seamstress in the 1900s, falls in love with a man who then takes all her money, and the last closing shot after three acts is her at her sewing machine, and then it fades into like a sepia picture, and there's a caption that says, "Anonymous, like unnamed Negro woman." Huh. And the whole idea is that in this time period, she's just this unnamed, you know, just like a lot of pictures you would find of this era, that, you know, she's just someone that you would just pass along and ignore when she has so much going on.
I thought as I was reading this that it also really caught the sense of Janie being just sort of catatonic with grief at this point. Now the racial issues here are really interesting, and I think again this is a kind of is like a bit touchy, but Hurston sets up the black men in her life, the friends of Tea Cake, are gunning for her conviction. They just want to see justice for Tea Cake, and it is the white jury who acquit her, and then she is, as she leaves the courtroom, she's protected by a sort of a phalanx of white women. And Hurston followed Boaz's ideas on race, insofar as Boaz was an early supporter of the idea that race was completely culturally determined, that there was nothing genetic about it at all, that it was simply about what your upbringing was. And I think that Hurston was reflecting a bit of this here, insofar as she was, I
struggle with this, with that chapter as well. I think I would not be surprised if this was a scene that was unfavorable with her contemporaries,
right?
Because it does paint the black people that she knew in Jacksonville very unfavorably. Though I do think later on the narrator does explain that they did not understand exactly what rabies was, despite Dr. Simmons explaining it. And it seems to be I think that the narrator is trying to say that they feel grief and they're trying to find a target, because once they eventually, forgive Janie and they're very ashamed at how they treated her, the narrator says they literally pick another target, which is Mr. Turner, Mrs. Turner's brother.
I think that Hurston, the narrator, the omniscient narrator of this book, is extremely generous to everybody. It's funny because in some ways we follow Janie's point of view so closely, and then suddenly we have these little asides. As you mentioned at the beginning, it says, of the next chapter, it says that Teacake's friends were all so ashamed, and it's sort of like we have a limited narrator who's taking Janie's side, but from time to time it's going to just give us these little glimpses into other people's motivations. In any case, after this, Janie leaves Jacksonville and heads back to Eatonville, which is where we opened the novel with her discussion with Phoebe. And
there's a quote that I just really fell in love with. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah. Where Janie's talking to Phoebe and just explaining, you know, she is upset about, of course, losing Tea Cake, but she's saying how, you know, people won't understand really the love I had, because love isn't something like grindstone that's the same everywhere. Love is like the sea, it's a moving thing and still and all, but it takes its shape from the shore it meets, and it's different with every shore. Which I thought was such a beautiful encapsulation of what she's just been through.
Right.
And it does, I think that the story does end with, like we had said before, she's been through great things and she's been through bad things, and that ending metaphor where she pulled in her horizon like a great fishnet. And it includes so much of her life in the meshes. And I think that it shows that everything she's been through, she invites her soul to see, to revel in the woman that she is now.
It's an incredibly moving final couple pages. And it's an odd passage for me to try to characterize, because in many ways one could call the book a tragedy in a traditional sense, but on the other hand, it's a triumph for Janie, in that she has arrived at this point and come through adversity and grief with an enormous amount of integrity and self-knowledge. And just as before, where Janie packed up and moved, there's no reason to believe that this is any kind of an end for her. This is kind of just another start for her life. And I when I read this this ending, I find myself having this mixture of sadness and joy that I have a hard time characterizing, except saying that's really the magic of the novel.
Yeah, and she still, I mean, in the very end, she does envision Tea Cake prancing around her and covering her up like that warm shawl, so she still loves Tea Cake.
As you yourself mentioned, Janie is not going to be defined by her romantic relationships. She's going to, she moves from one to another, and she trades up, and they each have good things and bad things about them, but ultimately this is a story about Janie's relationship with herself. Let's talk just a little bit here about Hurston's style. we do these readings on sophomore lit, and this time we're going to actually discuss a passage from the start of the book, which is kind of unusual, but it is the passage of Janie under the pear tree.
She was stretched on her back beneath the pear tree, soaking in the alto chant of the visiting bees, the gold of the sun and the panting breath of the breeze when the inaudible voice of it all came to her. She saw a dust-bearing bee sink into the sanctum of the bloom. The thousand sister calyxes arched to meet the love embrace and the ecstatic shiver of the tree from root to tiniest branch, creaming in every blossom and frothing with delight. So this was a marriage. She had been summoned to behold a revelation. Then Janie felt a pain remorseless sweet that left her limp and languid.
This is a great example of the incredibly elevated voice of the omniscient narrator in this book. And I don't know. I mean, I don't have too much to say about it other than to say that there are many passages in this book where I wanted to stop and read them aloud. But when you pair that, of course, with the dialect, it creates a kind of a really rich interplay of voices between Janie's thoughts and her words.
To quickly jump ahead, the Zadie Smith article I read touched on people critiquing the fact that, oh, to fully encapsulate, you know, the real black womanness of it all, why was it not in first person? But I think that if this was in first person in Janie's voice, I think that distinction between the narrator and the people talking would be completely lost. And I think that I don't know if we touch about this enough, but in a sense, nature and God is their own character, this is why it's about herself in that relationship and not love stories, so to say, because the title during the hurricane, which is Their Eyes Were Watching God, is all these characters watching what's going to happen to them next, all these things that are out of their control. So I think that when the narrator in Zora Neale describes so much of nature, it's always very rich and usually tied to the different characters. Like when she says Janie sees herself like a great tree and leaf with the things that she suffered and things enjoyed. And so I think that it's always when you forget that it's going to happen, Zora Neale will then intertwine the characters with the nature and environment around them.
I'm tempted to end it here, but is there anything you'd like to say as a last word?
Thank you so much, John, for making me feel like a great black woman. No. You know, I mean, this is absolutely a touchstone, I think, in the black experience and the black female experience within the past 30 years and that resurgence. And I always did feel a bit missing out, I guess. And so making me reread this book really made me fall in love with Janie. We basically have the same name anyway. And it's just such a gorgeous book, and I can't wait to read more Zora Neale Hurston.
Thanks again to my co-host, Jane Dempsey. If you've been looking for a way to support Sophomore Lit, now there is one. The Incomparable Network now has a membership system that lets you sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Here's what to do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up for a membership. You'll be asked to pick shows on the Incomparable Network you'd like to support. If you just like Sophomore Lit, your entire contribution will go to that after fees. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, and if you don't, why don't you? You can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you, members will receive extras, including exclusive bonus audio tracks, a live bootleg feed of The Incomparable, and other cool stuff. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. So again, if you'd like to support Sophomore Lit, go to theincomparable.com members to sign up. As always, you can join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page or write the podcast at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Permission slips for this field trip are not required. And remember, everything will be on the final.